This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Box office top 10 this week. Lots of correspondence already on Spider-Man. People who've seen it. Lots of people who've enjoyed playing the game from last week, taking some of the words that you said about movies and completely twisting it out of all proportion. Anyway, at 10 we have The Lives of Others.
Which, as I said, it's good. It's a good, solid, well-made thriller and very impressive debut feature. It isn't Pan's Labyrinth, and I think that the Academy were wrong to give it the Best Foreign Language Oscar, and BAFTA made a better decision because they gave that to Pan's Labyrinth. So it's good, but it's like... How Green Was My Valley winning the Oscar for Best Picture the year that Citizen Kane didn't.
Tara Rum Pum.
Which I haven't seen. It's an American-Indian co-production. It appears to be about families and race cars, and I'm open to anyone sending me a review if you've actually seen it.
Mayo@bbc.co.uk. Shooters at 8.
Mark Wahlberg is fine. I mean, not a great movie.
You finally got to see it, yeah. How long did that take you?
It was a couple of weeks. Yeah, but that's the thing, you see. If you take a couple of weeks off, what happens is, it used to be every week 5 movies open. Now, every week 10, 11 movies open. So if you miss a week, the backlog is very... Anyway, it was fine. It's Mark Wahlberg. It's nothing to write home about, but it's fine.
The Painted Veil is this week's number 7.
Which is much better than I thought it was going to be, in part due to the presence of Toby Jones, who I think is a really, really interesting actor. But also,
we should have him on the programme, shouldn't we?
We should have him on the programme. He is very good. I met his brother yesterday.
I don't want to interview his brother, though, do I?
No, I wasn't saying you should do. It was just weird. I was down at Pinewood doing something, you know, because that's what I do. And this bloke came up to me and said, "You're Mark." And I said, "Yes." He said, "I'm Toby Jones's brother." There was really nothing else I could say other than I'm very pleased to meet you. Anyway.
A very engaging story as far as it went.
Thank you very much. It was funny. I was halfway through it and I realised it was about as funny as your story about interviewing Jack Straw and saying good morning. But there we are. We're on evens
Which
now.
Would have been interesting if I got the words in the right order.
But The Painted Veil is good. And I was genuinely moved by it. And I know the thing everyone says about it is that it's beautifully shot, which it is. But I think it's actually a pretty substantial work as well.
Alpha Dogs at 6.
You know, really, if I wanted to see this movie... I mean, the thing is, go and watch the Larry Clark film, OK? Larry Clark's Bully does all the things that this movie does, and it does it in a way which is edgier and seedier and nastier, and it has to be said, rather better. I mean, people have gone mad and said, well, Justin Timberlake is a real revelation. Well, he's not that much of a revelation. He's playing a bloke who walks around, you know, with his trousers hanging halfway down his thighs, being... Well, it's sort of Justin Timberlake-y kind of character. It's based on a true story, which is a very, very distressing true story, and it is a, you know, a rather worrying portrait of teenage wildlife, but I'm not entirely sure that you can do that sort of thing, and then, oh, look, it's, you know, star turned by the likes of Sharon Stone.
Blades of Glory at 5.
Which is funny. I did laugh. I mean, I've never been a big Will Ferrell fan. I don't think I ever am going to be, but I did like the thing about the two guys, the only way they can ice skate, the only way they can get round being banned from ice skating is that they can ice skate together as a duo. And it, you know, it's him and John Heder from Napoleon Dynamite, and it is funny, and I laughed despite myself.
Mr. Bean's Holiday at 4.
I mean, just grim. And I went into the first Mr. Bean movie with an open mind, and I actually did quite like it. I think the first Mr. Bean movie was directed by Mel Smith.
It was.
And he, you know, Mr. Bean was sort of talking. In this, he does the same thing, but he only what?
Your impressions. I just don't want to start on that slippery slope.
No, but you know that is what the whole difference is. That in the movies, he does have a few words, and they're like we non gracias. That's it. And I honestly, 5 minutes into Mr. Bean's Holiday, I just thought I've never liked Monsieur Hulot. I've never liked Jacques Tati. But frankly, stick me in a room with the entire back catalogue of Jacques Tati's films playing simultaneously for 48 hours rather than endure this horror.
Fracture at number 3.
Sir Anthony Hopkins. You're just giving them to me now, you see. It's just a clean run of it's fine, stupid thriller with Sir Anthony Hopkins.
He's just an impression, although he never talks.
No,
like
he
that.
Doesn't do that.
Who does?
The person who does the trailer for the movies that Sir Anthony Hopkins is in. But in this movie, Sir Anthony Hopkins plays a person at the beginning of the film, kills his wife, and then says, ah, yeah, we'll prove that I did it. And it's a kind of legal, interesting court case. Aha, we think we've got him banged to rights, but he's such a smart guy. But here's the interesting thing is he might be Irish, he might be Scottish, he might be Welsh, he might be American, because I can't tell because he does a little bit of this and then a little bit of that and then a little bit.
Enough
down
already.
There
Wild Hogs at 2.
Finally saw it. Boring.
That was worth waiting for. And the UK's number one is Next.
Which is incredible, right? It's absolutely incredible. This totally rubbish film. And the whole gag that everyone's made about Next is because Nick Cage can see in the future. right? He can see only a couple of minutes in the future, but he can see in the future. And the gag that everyone made is, you know, stop me if you've seen this one before, which we all have. And but apparently the nation has taken it to their heart and it's gone in number one. Here's my prediction for next week. It won't be in the top 10. Or if it is, it'll be in the nether areas of the top 10. It'll be somewhere around about number 7. It's an opening weekend movie followed by a very swift closing week movie.
We'll find out next week. Mayo@bbc.co.uk. I imagine we'll be starting with Spider-Man.
We will start with Spider-Man.
We'll talk Spider-Man in just a moment. Last week on the programme, you might remember we were talking about the new rules that apparently, these are European rules, that will stop theatres selectively quoting from reviews, meaning that it'll be no longer possible or legal to cherry-pick the best bits to alter the overall review. So last week we said a challenge to completely, using your words, change the meaning of your film reviews. Well, one listener called Darren Haru, who's in Vancouver, he has taken the whole thing one step further.
Has he?
Yeah. And he says, greetings, Simon and Mark.
Hello, Darren.
He's in Vancouver. And hello to Jason Isaacs.
Oh, hello, Jason Isaacs. And hello to David Morrissey.
David Morrissey, wherever they are. As per Simon's request to alter Mark's movie quote, I've transformed the Good Doctor's nasty review of Straight Heads into a full-blown, glowing tribute.
Ah.
You'll find the short MP3 sample attached to this email. Keep up the good work. If we double-click on it, it sounds like this. Yeah, there's an email from Jeremy. He says, on Straight Heads, Kermode is either going to love it or hate it. Looking forward to finding out which one.
I love Straight Heads. I was very impressed by it. It is a British rape revenge thriller. It's shocking, disturbing, extraordinary. It's really, I think, making a serious point about the nature of, you know, violence corrupts.
And if you had to, your movie of the week.
My movie of the week, Straight Edge. But can I also shout out, yeah, I've got a thing. What do you want to do? You're a geezer. You're a geezer. You get in a car and you do the thing and then it's...
See?
That's really scary, though, isn't it?
It is scary because
it's really scary.
Proves we can manipulate. Once your words are out there...
I know.
Weird and strange people like Darren in Vancouver can... Because people out there might not know you and your reputation, and they'll listen to that and they go, wow, that...
Yeah, yeah, he must be rubbish, wasn't he?
He's really stupid. Anyway.
As I said, the greatest lifting from a quote was Trevor Johnson from Time Out magazine in London reviewed the Bruce Willis film, The Colour of Night, and the first four words of the review were astonishing, unbelievable, you know, like four big adjectives, and then the character continued, Bruce Willis's latest crime against cinema defies description, and they literally just took the four adjectives, Trevor Johnson Time Out. I think he was genuinely quite cross about it.
Mayo@bbc.co.uk, lots of emails, lots of correspondence, but we need to talk about Spider-Man 3, it being the most publicised of this week's offerings.
Let's take a deep breath, because it's going to take huge amounts of money, and it will obviously be number one next week.
So critic-proof, then?
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely, because it's, you know, it's a franchise, it makes no difference what the critics say about it at all, it makes no odds. So, as you probably know, I'm a big fan of Sam Raimi. I really like The Evil Dead. I really, really like Evil Dead 2. I think that he's, you know, he's a great kinetic director. He's got a great pop sensibility. Anyone whose movie was outlawed under the Video Recordings Act, you know, for 10 years can't be all bad.
You
in
have
my book.
Said all this before and to Sam Raimi on the programme
fine.
A couple of weeks
okay.
ago.
So
feel free to move on.
Okay, fine. So Spider-Man 1, good. Spider-Man 2, better. Spider-Man 2 was great because Spider-Man 2 was all about him, you know, his adolescence. It was all about him, you know, coming of age and having, you know, great sort of social problems with that. Now Spider-Man 3 is about, well, it's sort of about everything. If you attempt to do a plot synopsis, you'll just get lost. But basically what happens is, carrying on from where the story was in Spider-Man 2, Spider-Man 3 gives us Peter Parker still having problems with the newspaper, still having problems with Mary Jane, who he's back together again with, but then he's not back together again with, because she's sort of being wooed by the son of the Green Goblin. He's up against a man who gets turned into sand, the Sandman. How scary is that? A meteorite from outer space which delivers black gloop onto his costume and creates a bad, dark version of Spider-Man. And all these threads sort of mesh together and sort of don't at the same time. You know that things aren't going well when a character has to be given amnesia so that they forget enough of the plot, that the plot may be repeated without them saying, hang on, didn't we do all this? And the central rival for Mary Jane's affection does literally lose his mind in order that they can go back over a whole bunch of ground they did before. I really wanted to like Spider-Man 3 because I really like the idea that you have a big subversive blockbuster in amidst all the... You know, we've got the summer of threequels coming up. We've got Pirates of the Caribbean 3, which I'm already starting to get a headache about. We've got Rush Hour 3. We've got Die Hard 4. That's a fourquel. I mean, we've got a Harry Potter
fight. That's a great word.
Is it?
A forkful.
Good. Well, it sounds like something out of those two Ronnie sketches.
But so it's a quadrilogy, I think.
A quadrilogy, yeah. Right? Quartet, I think, is what they're called. But so I really wanted Spider-Man 3 to be the one that gave me something else, that said, yes, fine, Sam Raimi's got in, he's made a kind of interest mainstream movie. Yes, it's millions and millions of dollars, but hey, he's done stuff that's really subversive and dark and strange. And the trailer looked great. I mean, I remember when I saw the trailer the first time, I thought, wow, this is it, Dark's Web, terrific. It's a mess. It's a total mess. And it's a real shame. There are some set pieces which are okay. However, in the first film, the scenes of Spider-Man swinging between the buildings, which are done on CGI, lacked a kind of physicality. In the second film, they seem to solve that problem. And actually, the scenes of him swinging on the spider nets were much more physical. I thought, wow, they've really sorted this out. They have given physicality to the CG graphics. Spider-Man 3, we're right back to where we were with the first one. You get these enormous set pieces, but absolutely no sense of physicality, despite the massive amount of banging into things. I mean, Raimi's always been great at being banging into things. He made a terrific movie, Crime Wave, and it was literally a frying pans in the face and dong, bang, bing.
Well, the opening sort of action sequence, which, as I remember, takes quite a long time to get there.
It does.
When Spider-Man against his sort of nemesis.
Yes.
The reason why he loses his memory, which you're talking about, is the amount of bangs on the head that he gets in that opening duel. But it's fantastically done. I mean, that opening section.
It is well done. It's not fantastically done. It's well done CG, but it lacks physicality. It doesn't have the weight, the heft that the action sequences did in Spider-Man 2. Now, it's interesting because we saw the film together, and at the end of that sequence, there was a round of applause in the cinema, wasn't there? People just cheered. In the same way that I remember sitting next to Ann V. Coates, the editor, watching The Matrix Reloaded, and at the end of the chase sequence in The Matrix Reloaded, there was a round of applause. But it was more out of relief than anything else, because up until that point, really not very much had happened. And then we get, a character will be introduced. He breaks out of jail, gets turned into sand, and then we forget about him for a little while. Then a meteorite lands and some gloop rhymes, and that happens. And then we forget about that for a little while. Then we have some stuff with Mary Jane. Then we have a fantastic comic interlude with Bruce Campbell, who I always love. Bruce Campbell. Bruce Campbell, the star of the Evil Dead movies, as Sam Raimi said, they always worked with him because he was very handsome. His fantastic biography, If Chins Could Kill, Confessions of a B-Movie Star. And he's a great guy, and he plays the maitre d'. In the other Spider-Man movie, he plays the guy who won't let Peter Parker into the theatre to see Mary Jane's production. But he plays the maitre d'. There's a funny little routine when Peter Parker wants to propose to Mary Jane, and he's the French. Where he actually comes on all John Cleese at that point.
Yeah, it's very much like Python-esque.
Yeah, sort of Mr. Creosote, isn't it? But it's completely self-contained. Then there's another section when he suddenly gets all cocky and confident because he's got the black Spider-Man thing in, and he walks down the street as if he's in Saturday Night Fever. These are all set pieces, but they're not set pieces that hang together. And the problem is that since they don't hang together in any particular order, you start to feel, gosh, we've been here for a long time, haven't we? My bottom's starting to hurt. Did I leave the gas on? I'm starting to get a bit of a backache. Hang on, isn't this a bit from Spider-Man 2? Where's Dr. Octopus gone? Because I'd like him to come in and sort things out. And I was starting to get really frustrated. And worse of all, I was starting to get bored. And the thing that would have been maybe the redeeming grace was that it finished with some sense of, enormous conclusion. But it didn't. It didn't. What happened was you felt that all the issues, the emotional issues, the proper solid emotional issues to do with adolescence, to do with him and his girlfriend, to do with his identity, to do with not wanting to be Spider-Man and still wanting to be Spider-Man at the same time, were all dealt with in Spider-Man 2. And funny thing is, watching Spider-Man 3 made me realise just how right I was about Spider-Man 2. Because I thought it was a great movie, and some people were a bit lukewarm about it. I said, no, you're absolutely wrong. It's a really, really great movie. And you watch Spider-Man 3 and you go, no, I was right. Because this is a shambles. I mean, it's and here's the other comparison. Evil Dead 1, great. Evil Dead 2, really great. Evil Dead 3, Army of Darkness, total disaster in every area. And it's the same with Spider-Man. 1, good. 2, really good. 3, somebody grabbed me an editing machine and cut this down to 90 minutes. Because, you go in the morning, you come out for the next day. You were bored. You were bored.
I wasn't bored. I was certainly getting that way. And it was, you're absolutely right, it was far too long. And you think, no, you can lose some of this, lose 20 minutes.
Lose a lot of it. You can lose whole villains.
It wouldn't be a problem. Here's an interesting email from Ollie in London. It says, I saw Spider-Man 3. As a man who thought the second movie was a major improvement over the first, my optimism was smashed by a turgid third instalment that did nothing but show off yet again CGI with nice colour but no logic.
Exactly, exactly. What's the guy's name?
So when I said this is from Ollie, you weren't listening at that point.
No, I was listening. It's just I wasn't listening fast enough.
Yet again, CJ, nice colour, but with no logic in its physical reality.
Exactly.
Hang on.
Sorry.
The storyline introduced and killed plots every 2 seconds, and the occasional laugh couldn't make up for the fact that, like The Matrix Revolution or X-Men 3, the final instalment in these blockbusters is always overloaded with digital effects, corny cliches, and embarrassing sentimentality. A moment where a rejuvenated Spider-Man swings in to save the day with a massive American flag behind him caused the entire audience I was with to groan as one. On the plus side, the moral message was consistent to the previous films, and the Sandman CGI was terrific, it being the runaway highlight to an otherwise derivative and boring franchise killer.
Well, I'm that's a man after my own heart, and that's you're wrong about the Matrix. The last Matrix movie is actually better than the second Matrix movie, but other than that,
no, I don't think so.
It was.
They got progressively worse.
No, they didn't. No, the first Matrix movie was great. The second Matrix movie was a bunch of chase sequences with one great chase in the middle and nothing else. And the third Matrix movie came back some of the way and ended up with the kind of, you know, with the death and resurrection thing, which it needed to do. But it was better than the one in the middle. What the one in the middle was is Matrix, and there's Matrix Reloaded. Reloaded was the one that didn't work at all. It was just chase sequences.
Russell, this is Russell Stafford, says, is the 12A certificate Spider-Man 3 really needed? Because Spidey 2 was a PG, and my 8-year-old son, who loves Spidey 2, has bugged me for weeks to take him to see Spider-Man 3. He can't go, and it's a shame. Well, obviously, he can go because it's 12A,
yes.
So it's entirely down to Russell and his opinion. So this is a tricky one, isn't it?
Well, it's an interesting case because you and I have both seen this, OK? So I think that Spider-Man 2 was a pretty tough PG, but I was thrilled that it was a PG because I have watched it, you know, with my kids, and they really, really like it. Although I watched it on DVD, which is a rather different experience because you can manage it. Also, Spider-Man 3 is a loud film. I mean, nowadays, a really big budget movie has to be loud. I think that 12A is right. The general rule with 12A is anyone under 8 is not, you know, you shouldn't really, because it's, you know, the idea was that 8 would be, sorry, that sentence didn't make any sense. The idea was that a 12A certificate, the lowest age should be 8, okay? Don't bring anyone below the age of 8. I think Spider-Man 3 does deserve the 12A certificate. Although I have to say, not because there's anything deeply disturbing in it, but it's just an awful lot of bang, crash, wallop, bang, crash, wallop. But there's nothing sort of hideously unpleasant.
Because Spider-Man was, I think, famously the first 12A.
Yes, well, they reclassified it, didn't they? Because it came out as a 12, and then everyone complained, and then they reclassified it as a 12A, and they reissued it as a 12A. So you couldn't really see it.
It's going to be entirely down to a parent and their kid, because they're going to be 8-year-olds.
What do you think? You think for young kids?
I think, you're right. I mean, it's very borderline. Probably does deserve to be a 12A, but Russell's going to have to go and see it and decide, because it may well be that his kid will love it, especially having sort of been baptised into the Spider-Man genre with Spider-Man 2.
It felt very light to me, but there is an awful lot of fighting.
After a while, Russell, your kid might say, blimey, this is a bit long, Dad. Can we go now?
Yeah, exactly. They're playing Battle of Algiers next door. Can we go and see that?
So you've heard what Mark thinks. We'd like to hear your opinion of Spider-Man 3. If you manage to see the film before next Friday, we'd like you to record your own review. Send it to us via the website. We'll put the best ones online, and if they're good enough, we might even use them. There are more
details. Am I getting fired?
No, it's a corporate thing.
Oh, I'm just checking.
No, you're absolutely fine. This is a corporate thing. I've got my corporate voice on.
Fine, as you were.
There are more details on how you can do this on the 5Live website. Go to bbc.co.uk/5Live and click on the link.
I'm calling the union
page. Sir Anthony Hopkins. It's 3:41, Damien, on this email, which he headlines The Kermode Dichotomy. Yeah. Whilst I thoroughly enjoy the rantings of Mr. Kermode and his sidekick on a Friday afternoon, and occasionally the podcast, I'd like to point out that there is a price to pay for digesting the aired options. It seems to me that watching movies during the course of one's employment gives one altered views of the subject matter. Is it possible for Mr. Kermode to see a movie simply to relax, which for most of us is the reason for going? Or does he have to dissect the movie into meaningful minutiae every time? The reason for this observation is that at the weekend, my daughter and I sat down to watch Happy Feet, and while she sang and danced through the entire film with utter joy, I could not get Mr. Kermode's angst-ridden review out of my head. And when the tap-dancing penguin finally made the humans change their greedy ways, I was left emotionless as my daughter was near to tears. Did Mr. Kermode change my appreciation of a wonderful moment? Yes. Was his review more entertaining than the movie itself? No. Do you see my dilemma?
Yeah, I mean, my kids love Happy Feet. They're wrong. you know, I'd put them on the straight and narrow about that, but what can I do?
Stop enjoying yourself. Maybe. I know you're having a lovely time. I know you think that that's the meaning of life, and I know you're all crying, but you are wrong.
And incidentally, I do watch movies for enjoyment. You know, the good lady wife and I sat down to watch Ken Russell's The Devils just the other night, and we really enjoyed that enormously.
Bring the family round. this is Adam, Spider-Man 3, the most thoroughly disappointing film I've ever had the misfortune of seeing at the cinema. First two were great. Raimi's dropped the ball. Sarah in Sheffield, sorry not to see This Is England in the top 10 this week. Best film I've seen for ages. Compassionate, soulful, funny, sad, thought-provoking.
Wonderful film.
And wonderful. Alan, why is Mark's Sir Anthony Hopkins an octave higher this week? Or even an active higher? Is it his homage to wayward acting? And Naki, helping us out in Tooting, saw Tara Rumpum last night. This is number 9
good,
in the chart.
Yes.
Mark hadn't seen it. Disappointed, not as good as the director's debut movie. Not that funny, not that engaging. It's Cinderella Man with racing cars replacing the boxing, but not as good.
Thank you very much for
what
that.
What else is new?
Fast Food Nation. Fast Food Nation, famous book by Eric Schlosser, which was a sort of factual account of the terrible things going on in the burger industry. This is a film adaptation by Richard Linklater, who also made A Scanner Darkly. This time last year, Richard Linklater had two films at Cannes, Fast Food Nation and Scanner Darkly. Scanner Darkly is, you know, opened and now come out on DVD. And this, which is only opening now, it's been a year, long time coming. This is a fictional adaptation of the book, scripted by Eric Schlosser and Richard Linklater. So out go the sort of hard facts, in comes sort of soft drama. Out goes all the talk about McDonald's. In comes fictional burger chain Mickey's. The story is, you see how they did that? The story is Greg Kinnear works for the burger chain and is sent out on the road to investigate allegations that there is something other than meat in the meat. And you will remember what the real allegations of this were. This fecal matter. This was what the whole issue was about. And so Greg Kinnear goes out on the road and he meets a number of people. He meets disgruntled young students working at the outlet. He meets ranchers whose businesses are falling down because of the burger's practice. He goes to the place where the meat is made, which factory is entirely run by Mexican workers who've had a terrible time coming across the border. So we see all these strands, all these kind of traffic-like strands, all coming together in Greg Kinnear's journey, which sort of fictionally matches the kind of factual findings of the book. And in the middle of it, Bruce Willis turns up.
Oh, good.
And Bruce Willis...
In a vest?
Not in a vest, sadly enough. And Bruce Willis delivers the speech, the central speech, about how it is that the burger industry works. Now, when I was in Cannes, I met Richard Linklater and I said, you know, the most subversive thing about the film, which I thought was very subversive, was that Bruce Willis plays this guy who says that actually you have to put up with the fact that meat is full of poo and there's nothing you can do about it. And I said, it was because it's very funny, because Bruce Willis is famously one of the people that set up Planet Hollywood, you know, the burger chain. So it's Bruce Willis, Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger. And they said it. I said, I thought that was really right. And he went, oh, yeah, I never thought about that. Which is a shame, because that's the best gag in the film. The rest of the film, which is a perfectly fine piece of work, you just sit there thinking, we've had Super Size Me, we had the book, we know the factual stuff, do I need to see it again in the watered-down light version? I think that what they've attempted to do is to retool it, to aim it at a young, teenage, hip, and I have to say, in the way the film talks about fairly dumb audience, frankly, to make this stuff palatable, actually to make a kind of fast food version of Fast Food Nation that the young kids will somehow find, you know, that they can chow down on without it feeling like they're actually going through the effort of watching a documentary. It's not a bad film. It's just a very, very strange sanitization of a very hard-hitting expose of what's going on in the fast food industry. And there are moments in it that you think that's fine. There's loads of celebrity cameos. You know, Avril Lavigne turns up, Ethan Hawke's in it, Chris Christopherson's in it, and of course Mr. Bruce Willis doing the subversive thing that apparently nobody other than me noticed was subversive at the time. But you do get the sense of, haven't we done all this? And didn't we do it all much more hard-hitting? And I know certainly there is a sense that, okay, you can't read the book, you can't take the documentary, so here's the CBeebies drama version of it.
Mark, thanks very much indeed. More reviews coming up. You can correspond, of course, mayo@bbc.co.uk. It's 5 live, 30 minutes to 4. As you heard, well, it is. It is one of those, isn't it, really? Is it time for bed already? Simon Rich on this is, my wife and I moved to Bermuda 2 years ago. We're regular listeners to your weekly podcast with The Good Doctor, as it provides a welcome link back to UK culture. We were back in London for a few days this week. We're surprised to see The Good Doctor moonlighting in front of the camera in Notting Hill. we wondered whether he was participating in a remake of a Richard Curtis
movie. Oh, yeah,
where
yeah.
the hero, rather than running a bookstore, runs the local cinema and rants regularly about the quality of the releases. Are you making a movie?
No, we did a thing for the Culture Show about, you know, great locations in British film. And one of the things that we have done, having done Clockwork Orange and, you know, 28 Days Later, they said, oh, we need something nice. Let's go and do Notting Hill. So we went to that bookshop, the travel bookshop, you know, that Hugh Grant goes, yeah, but it's, you know, it's not Notting Hill, is it? I mean, it's Richard Curtis's front room. I love Richard Curtis as a screenwriter.
It is Notting Hill.
It isn't. Well, it is and it isn't.
Yes, so it is. Then.
No, it isn't.
Well, of course it is.
It's not the version of Notting Hill in that film.
Then?
It's like Mars. I mean, it's like it's like Brigadoon.
But it's Notting
Hill. It's shot in Notting Hill.
That'll make it Notting Hill then. What else is new we got?
Bridge to Terabithia, which is the latest from Walden Media, who are the sort of, you know, company who backed the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe movies. And I think, once again, they have the kind of, you know, the Christian lobby behind them in this. They make a certain kind of borderline fantasy movie that are meant to be sort of slightly spiritually enriching if you're looking for that sort of thing. It's from a novel, which I confess I haven't read, a story about a misfit boy whose new neighbour turns out to be an equally misfitting young girl. He's bullied. She looks a little bit like Avril Lavigne, and she doesn't have I've said Avril Lavigne twice. I'm suddenly like, you know, hey, I'm down with the kids. Now, it's a very odd little movie. I mean, for a good half of it, I was kind of with it. I thought it's just nice because it's about, you know, misfit boy, misfit girl, both are given equal prominence. It'd be very good to take the kids to because, you know, it's not like a boy's own adventure. It's not a girl's own adventure. It works across the board. And it's a bit odd in that Terabithia doesn't really happen. They sort of describe Terabithia, and there are little bits of, like, there's a little bit of a walking tree, there's a little bit of a troll. But if you've seen the trailer, there's really, the trailer implies that there's a lot more special effects, supernaturally stuff in it than there actually is. Most of it is just a drama about these two kids, you know, finding friendship together. And then, about two-thirds of the way through, something happens, which is on a par with that moment in My Girl when the something happens with Macaulay Culkin and the bees. And you either decide that the drama has earned the right to go to this place, or, as in my case, you go, oh, no. Now, clearly this is an essential part of the story. And before that, you have a conversation between the two kids about whether or not it's a good idea to go to church. One of them goes to church and thinks it's boring. The other one doesn't go to church, but actually thinks religion is quite interesting. But it's very light. It wears its spirituality, in inverted commas, very lightly. It's not a sort of, you know, a brow-bashing affair. But I really did think that two-thirds of the way through, it sort of lost the plot and it tried to turn into something that's darker and more significant. And then it spent another third of the movie trying to tie up all its loose ends and doing a great big homespun moral thing. And by the end of it, I had completely lost my patience with it. And the thing it reminded me of was, there's a film out at the moment, another kids' movie, The Last Mimsy. I don't know whether people have gone to see that, but there's ambition in The Last Mimsy. It's a kids' movie that does deal with, you know, loss and darkness and worry and fear and all those things. And I admire it for that. And in the case of Bridge to Terabithia, I quite admire the fact that it attempts to deal with some difficult subject matter. The problem is, I don't think it does it successfully. The BBFC rating is PG, contains scary scenes and emotional distress. The emotional distress, though, I think, incidentally, is referring to the emotional distress in the audience as opposed to the emotional distress of the characters. But it was a shame because I was really with it for the first half, and then I really lost it for the second half. And I'd be very interested to hear from anybody who does take their kids to see it, whether the kids don't feel the same way, that it moves in, it hasn't earned the right to move into the particularly dark area that it does move into. And if you remember the scene I'm talking about in My Girl, I don't want to say it because I want to give away the twist, but it's just no. No, 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 no. Don't do that now. That's not the movie that we're in.
Steve in Newcastle. I think I've got time for this. I remember a couple of weeks ago, Mark sounded less than enthused by the prospect of seeing Grindhouse, Tarantino movie, exploitation double feature. How does he feel now that the movie will not be shown but split into two separate movies?
I mean, I could care less about Quentin Tarantino. It's the minute you get this thing, like, oh, Quentin Tarantino's making Grindhouse, it's an homage to... It's like, Quentin, I know, we all saw the films, we were all young, we all grew up. Can you please stop ramming it down our throats? I did, I have to say, really spitefully chuckle when the film didn't do very well in America, when people walked out after seeing the first movie not realising they had to sit through the whole double bill. And there's a hilarious piece in The Guardian today in which Quentin Tarantino says, I mean, I haven't seen the film, right? But Quentin Tarantino's talking about it as his, you know, his first real woman's picture. So, you know, hey, who knows? It may be fun. Everything about the publicity and every interview I've read with him just makes me want to smack him and go, Quentin, please stop it. You made Jackie Brown. It's a brilliant movie. It's the best thing you ever did. Why have you gone back to your sort of adolescent, you know, years? But it, hey, I haven't seen it. It may be a masterpiece.
Anything else to mention?
Very quickly, Goya's Ghost, which is a new film by Milos Forman. I have about 10 seconds. What I'm going to say is Milos Forman made Amadeus, your favourite movie, People vs. Larry Flint, Man on the Moon, etc. It's not really about Goya. It's about the Inquisition, and it's kind of like Ken Russell Light's strange version of The Devil's. Very good performance by Javier Bardem. In the end, all over the place, but at least politically ambitious.
Movie of the week?
Probably Goya's Ghost, actually. And it's a mess.
Good.
I'm not recommending
it,
but it's a bad week.
All the time that it needed.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live